Jurgen had a photography professor back in college in the 80s, Wiley Sanderson, who used to say, a thing is what it is only in relationship to what it's not.
And that's a powerful way to put it, because that red dress isn't just red, it's red against a room full of gray suits. The cold blue north isn't just cold, it's cold against a sun-baked King's Landing. When you lose that distinction, that's where tasteful and mute start becoming the same thing. That's the spine of this whole issue.
And that's what we're looking at in issue number 80 of the Intersect newsletter, titled Contrast is Meaning, Not Just Style. We're sitting with this one uncomfortable idea across four stories.
We'll see how modern TV went gray, the trick where filmmakers pick a fight on the color wheel, whether blurry backgrounds are quietly affecting movies, and an argument about whether AI is flattening creativity or freeing it up. It all comes back to contrast.
Let's start where it's most literally visible, the color of the screen itself. Modern TV has a sameness problem, and somebody finally put a name to it.
Yeah, this is a piece from Jason Hellerman at No Film School, and he's drawing on a video essay from a channel called Wow Them in the End. And the core argument is that, well, shows have traded warmth and saturated skin tones, you know, for diffused light and these really muted palettes. The example everyone brings up is early Game of Thrones. You had this cold Nordic north, and it really contrasted against a sun-baked King's Landing. But then you look at House of the Dragon, and everything just kind of collapsed into one, you know, tasteful gray.
I remember that feeling like everything was just sort of washed out.
Yeah, and Hellerman's key line from the piece is that the richness and variation of that world have been unified into one dull look. And the point there, that contrast in the early seasons, it wasn't just decoration. It told you where you were before anyone even spoke. So you lose it. You lose a quiet kind of meaning.
You know, that actually reminds me of something Jurgen mentioned. He said his wife, she refuses to watch most sci-fi because of what she calls the green tinge, that dystopian color wash that just screams misery before you hear a single line of dialogue.
Well, that's a real thing, that green tinge.
I always thought it was just, you know, a vibe, but I guess it really sets the tone, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And Jurgen's theory, and this is a really good one, is that maybe the flattening comes from the tools, you know, not the actual auteurs themselves. I mean, advanced color grading used to be this really specialized thing, living in expensive suites with seasoned colorists. Now it's just a panel and final cut on a laptop available to junior creators. And when everyone reaches for the same sliders, everyone kind of arrives at the same look. He made this comparison to the Instagram filter era, right? Where every vacation photo went hypersaturated, and then every reunion was bathed in that faded 1970s glow. The filter just became the style, and the style became everywhere.
So it's like a creative shortcut becomes universally available. And you wonder, does it expand our range or does it, like, quietly narrow it?
Exactly. It's a really good question to ask.
Hold that thought about the shortcut narrowing things, because the next piece argues the exact opposite case for contrast. This is what The Intersect does every week. It takes a thread like contrast is meaning and pulls it across film, photography, design, and AI without the hype or the doom. If you want curated stories from where art and technology meet with a real human point of view filtering every piece, subscribe to the newsletter at theintersect.art. Okay, back to the color wheel, but from the other direction. You know, this next piece talks about something I've seen 100 times in movies and never really put a name to it. That one object that just refuses to blend into the room.
Yeah, this is also from No Film School, and it talks about a technique called discordant color. It's all about palettes that deliberately clash to grab your eye and steer it. The unglamorous mechanics are pretty straightforward. You pick a color from the far side of the wheel, then you strip it out of everything else in the frame. Your eye just has no choice but to go there.
Like the woman in the red dress in The Matrix, right? Everyone else is in shades of green code, and then she walks in and your attention snaps directly to her.
Exactly. Or Almodovar, who Jurgen points to. He'll put a red phone on a green table, for example, before you even know why a phone matters. The piece says Almodovar clearly wants us to notice the phone, even though he hasn't told us why yet. Quickly, the scene reveals that Pepa is waiting for a call from her former lover, so the phone is looming large in her mind. It's all meaning before a single line of dialogue.
And I think of La La Land, too, where Emma Stone is always findable, no matter how crowded or busy the dance gets. It's no dialogue, no arrow pointing, just color theory telling you where to look.
And this is what's really interesting. It's the fun flip side of the gray screen story we just talked about. This is the opposite gamble, putting a single loud color back in and aiming it like a flashlight. The contrast here isn't decoration, it's the whole sentence. A director puts you inside a character's head through nothing but a green tabletop and that stubborn splash of red. It's manipulation, sure, but it's the honest kind, the kind that does its work and then steps back.
So if the gray screen was losing meaning by flattening everything, this is really weaponizing color to put meaning exactly where the director wants it. Whose attention is being borrowed and what are they doing with it?
Right. Story one showed us what happens when color drains away. This shows us the power of what happens when you intentionally bring it back to create a specific contrast.
Same idea told through focus this time instead of color. After the gray sky and the red dress, here's the same problem told through focus instead of color. It's like we're still talking about visual information, just a different dimension of it.
Exactly. There's this video essay from a creator called Extra Mint that asks why so much contemporary cinematography feels, well, weirdly flat. It points to our obsession with shallow depth of field, that creamy, bokeh-drenched look where the background just dissolves and only the speaking character stays sharp. Extra Mint argues that deep focus filmmaking, instead of locking you out and blurring everything, actually invites you to explore just as you would in real life. Think Orson Welles and Greg Toland in Citizen Kane fighting to keep a whole room in focus at once so multiple layers of action play out together. Or Kubrick, Kurosawa, even the entire Lord of the Rings. Deep focus was a story choice, not a technical limitation. It's the opposite of telling you where to look. It trusts you to look for yourself.
I remember Jurgen talking about this, and it feels pretty close to home for him, coming from photography.
It really does. Jurgen, you know, comes out of photography where depth of field, lenses, apertures, sensor sizes, all of that, it's a constant conversation. His read is that this shallow background look got fully democratized and in the process somewhat lobotomized. He sees portrait mode on an iPhone doing a passable simulation of what once needed a fast prime lens and real skill. And TikTok creators get that soft background look that used to cost serious money. He's fine with that, mostly, but when the shortcut becomes the default visual grammar of prestige TV and theatrical film, something gets lost. You collapse the contrast behind the subject, and you lose the sense of a world the character lives inside. He specifically leaned forward at the Welles and Toland and the Kubrick and Kurosawa references because they were making a choice.
So is this really the same complaint as the gray screen one? Is the curator forcing a connection here, or is it a genuinely related issue about artistic choice?
It's the same wound, just a different instrument. Flatten the contrast, whether it's blur, drained color, or uniform prose, and you lose the part that tells the audience what any of it means. It's not just an aesthetic preference, it's a communicative failure.
Same idea told through focus this time instead of color. Is the average answer an AI failure or a human one, do you think?
That's a good way to frame it, because it brings us right to Tani Martinetti's piece in Fast Company. He makes a compelling argument that AI, by gravitating toward what's statistically probable, is quietly sanding originality off the internet. His core claim is that we're not losing information, we're losing distinction. And he's not wrong about the real-world hook. He points to over 1,000 AI content farms churning out interchangeable articles, and that's genuinely a little disheartening.
But I think, and Juergen does too, that the leap from those content farms to saying AI is swapping creativity for average makes one use case for the whole story.
So it's not a complete picture then.
Juergen, in fact, wants to argue with that conclusion. He was just sharing that yesterday he heard from a group of writers who handed off all the scheduling, invoicing, social promotion, and wrote chores to AI tools. And the freed up headspace didn't make them blander. They're actually describing a creativity surge. That really complicates the tidy decline narrative, doesn't it? Juergen's own stance, and it's what the Intersect newsletter is built on, is that every piece gets filtered through a real human point of view. A model can tighten a sentence or fix grammar, but the stance has to come from a person. Nothing gets handed to a model to editorialize. He builds systems meant to keep AI-generated content anchored to authentic human writing.
So he's saying it's not the tool itself, but how we choose to use it, or rather, if we choose to use it at all.
Precisely. His read on Martinetti's real target isn't AI assistance, it's what he calls AI abdication, the choice to skip having a point of view at all. And he suspects that's more of a habit problem than a technology problem. Maybe temporary, while we all figure out where the human has to stay in the loop.
I hear that. So is the person making a choice to just let AI do the work and not bother with their own voice? Is that what Martinetti and the cinematographers are actually talking about? This wound of tonal uniformity that feels like a communicative failure, not just a clean aesthetic.
I think so. You could say distinction is just contrast by another name, couldn't you? A red dress only means something against a muted frame. A voice only registers against the flat hum around it. And the curator is always suspicious of panic, so this isn't a crisis, but it's a real question we need to sit with.
It makes you wonder.
If contrast is what tells you where you are and what matters, who's left to decide what matters when every frame and every sentence is equally technically correct?
Different medium now, but watch, it pulls on the exact same thread. So looking back across all these stories, from the gray skies and TV shows to the red dress problem, the blurry backgrounds, and then the average AI sentence, it really feels like it's the same lesson told in four different ways. Absolutely. When you strip out the difference, you don't end up with something
neutral, you get something silent. The power is in choosing where to put the emphasis, where the contrast should live.
If this kind of conversation is what you're looking for, where visual craft and machine-written prose start sounding like they're grappling with the same fundamental questions, Juergen would definitely tell you to come argue with him. You can subscribe and read his full take at theintersect.art.
We'll see you next time.